Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview with Pedernel Van Arsdale, author of The Beast is an Animal. Hey, Pedernel, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, broadcast at 11 a.m. Saturdays and 3 p.m. Tuesdays on 101.9 FM KVSH. You can learn more about the show at voiceofvashon.org or visit my website, marchtwisdale.com, to catch up on shows you've missed. So, let's see here. Pedernel, could you go ahead and give my listeners a background, just sort of like, you know, frame yourself for them so they have a sense of who you are and what you do?
Sure. I'm a writer now, but for most of my life, that was not even, you know, a thought in my head. Most of my career was spent as an editor, as a book editor. And in fact, I say that I was probably, you know, an editor from childhood. Certainly, in college, I was editing my friends' papers. It was what I loved to do. I didn't think of myself as being a creator, but rather as somebody who liked to help creators make their work as wonderful as it possibly could be. So right after college, I became a book editor. And then I worked for several large publishers in Manhattan. And I did that until about 7 or 8 years ago. And then I became a freelance editor and ghostwriter while I also worked on my own writing.
So did the transition for you happen around 2008 or so when the big publishing houses were sort of having their struggles?
Yeah, I guess the timing was roughly around then, but it's interesting. I don't necessarily think of 2008 as a particularly hard year for publishers because I feel like book publishers have struggled, you know, for many years now. I mean, when
it's true.
First got into publishing in the late 80s, that was still kind of a golden time, but that didn't last for that long after I got into publishing. And, you know, by the time we got to the mid to late 90s, you know, it was hard. That was when a lot of publishers were, you know, collapsing in on themselves, kind of growing and shrinking at the same time. There were fewer and fewer publishers.
Yeah. When did the Amazon effect, so to speak, start to hit the publishing industry? Was that in the 90s already?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, when Amazon first came on the scene, it was after Barnes & Noble had already been viewed as, you know, the big bad that had driven a lot of independents out of business. Kind of interesting to see the arc of that because, you know, now, if anything, I think Barnes & Noble is seen as being kind of a, you know, a bit of a bulwark against, you know, the expansion of Amazon. I'm not saying that independents love Barnes & Noble, but I don't think they so much hate the existence of Barnes & Noble anymore because they realize that the more booksellers there are, the better.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble is sometimes ironically seen as sort of like, you know, almost like a victim.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what comes around goes around, I guess. I mean, they really did. You know, I have many friends at Barnes & Noble, and I've worked at Barnes & Noble, and I, you know, booksellers are great people wherever they work.
Yeah.
Nobody is selling books to get rich. I mean, you know, maybe the CEOs are, but you know, the people who are actually on the ground selling the books are doing it because they love books.
Yeah.
It was very difficult to see so many independents fall victim to the growth of Barnes & Noble in the early days. I have seen some independents opening, and I've certainly seen some independents thriving, you know, particularly as I've visited them since my book came out and prior to my book coming out. You know, there are still really passionate people who both work in and shop in independent bookstores. So,
well, in a way, it's sort of like, I think, you know, the little pendulum swing. And I think it's like farmers markets, you know, they have had a resurgence because the mainstream society is starting to actually realize, you know, the food that's coming from five states away from some giant monocrop farm is not as good as what your neighbor's growing, you know, 3 miles away.
Right.
So we have had that as a resurgence. And then I think independent bookstores, it's almost as if they're starting to look around and, you know, Barnes & Noble's, in a way, had sort of the Walmart effect, you know, on a lot of independents. And now people are like, well, wait a minute, I liked my little neighborhood store where they knew me by name. And I could talk to a person who had been there for 30 years, you know.
Or even less time. I mean, you know, just people who are passionate about books.
Right.
And tell you, oh, you like this? Well, why don't you try this? I mean, the difficulty, you know, in the comparison between, say, a Green Market and a bookstore is that, you know, you're not going to look at the scallions at the Green Market and then go buy the scallions at the grocery store because, you know, they're cheaper. Because actually the scallions at the Green Market are pretty inexpensive and they look great. So, you know, you just buy them right there because you're already at the Green Market. The problem with the, you know, the showrooming that goes on with, you know, people going into independence and, you know, getting the recommendations and, you know, reading the great shelf talkers and things like that. And then, you know, buying the book more cheaply elsewhere. That's really tough. And I mean, that's not just booksellers. That's, you know, all kinds of retailers. But that's particularly rough. So I know personally, I make a pledge to myself that if I buy it where I see it, you know, if I, and I shop at independents, so, you know, I buy my books where I see them.
That's actually real. I really like that. I mean, you know, so we live on an island here and there's a lot of ethics around shop locally.
Yeah, that would be very powerful where you live. And it's even powerful where I live. I mean, very different island, Manhattan, but you know, we want our neighborhood to be diverse. We want different kinds of shops and we don't want all of our restaurants to be chains. So I try to buy, you know, some housewares at the little housewares store near me and not, you know, go to the big box store. Trying to buy locally is definitely important to me too.
I'm super excited about what we're going to talk about today. Of course, we've already had our little pre-chat, so I've got this lovely list of topics to cover. Looking at the book now, I have the advanced reader's copy. Did the front cover stay the same between this?
It did.
Okay.
It did.
Okay. All right.
My beautiful cover. I love it so much.
It is really amazing. And this is just beautiful front cover. And
thank you.
It's remarkable how this tree literally resembles both a tree and like a woman in a gown type of a thing. I mean, your artist did a great job.
Yeah, Sonia Chagas-Banyan at Simon Schuster Children's Books, specifically my publisher, my imprint, Margaret K. McElderry Books. She's a genius and she's wonderful. And I'm every day incredibly grateful to her because, you know, in my wildest dreams, I couldn't have come up with that. And it's so perfect.
Mm-hmm. So what's really cool, folks, about advanced reader copies, and you can come check this out, because this is a neat little piece about the publishing world for my listeners out there who are interested in writing their own book or just how things work, is an advanced reader's copy. It's not for sale or for quotation because things might still change. This copy will be put on my display at the Vashon Bookshop. So if you flip open to the first page, it's really cool because they have a list of all this interesting information that wouldn't normally be in the front of a book. And so it's saying the ages are, let's see, 14 up and 352 pages. So this is a great book for preteens and teenagers.
Definitely, yeah, because even though it says 14 and up, honestly, I mean, you know, it depends upon taste and sensibilities of the kid, but there's no reason. I mean, I would have read this when I was 11 or 12.
But yeah.
11 or 12, 12-year-olds are quite as interested in creepy things as I was, but, you know, certainly 13 and up. And the writing level is, you know, an adult level. So it really is crossover.
So The Beast is an Animal by Petronella Van Arsdell. This is in the vein of fairy tales. It's specifically, that was what you set out to create.
Yeah, I call it a dark fairy tale. And it was inspired by the fairy tales, the classic Grimm fairy tales, Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales that I read as a child and even into my, you know, early teens. I love them. And while it's entirely, you know, my own invention, it's not based on any particular one at all.
Right. No.
Certainly the themes of the fairy tales that I read all inform it. But, you know, as does my fascination with Bram Stoker's Dracula. And just recently I realized that I must have been inspired by Jane Eyre a little bit, because my character, my protagonist, Alice, is orphaned, and some of what she experiences, I know I had to have been informed by that. And it just occurred to me recently, it's funny how we absorb things and they come out of us.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and Jane Eyre is intense.
Very, very.
I have books I've read multiple times. Like, I've actually read The Stand by Stephen King, like, probably four times. And that's pretty intense. But I only read Jane Eyre once.
Oh, it's so wonderful. I want to read it again.
It's
It's one of
painful,
those,
though.
it is painful, but I think that it's one of those books that, depending upon your age, you read in different ways.
That's a
And
good
especially
point.
since she ages over the course of the novel. When I read it the first time, I was maybe 11 or 12. And so her experience as a child and just the physical deprivations she experienced were so powerful to me. And again, I know that I was inspired by that when I was writing The Beast as an Animal. I'm aware of it now, but I was unconsciously inspired by it as I was writing it.
So I've got a question here because I've only read this or parts of it, and you mentioned that the protagonist, her name is Alice.
Spelled
Now,
Alys.
right, I had thought of it as like Elise or something. And so did you name her basically a unique version of Alice because like a play on the Alice in Wonderland at all?
No, it's funny. Someone else asked me that recently. No, all the names and the places in the book are Welsh. And it was just a self-indulgent thing on my part because I've always had a romance with Wales, long before I was ever able to visit there. In fact, I wrote the book, a lot of the book, before I ever visited there. So even naming the people and the places Welsh names, it was before I ever went there. It's actually really difficult, you probably know this, to come up with a bunch of names to your characters.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't want to just kind of make them up. And so something just kind of, I just thought, oh, Welsh names, that would be lovely. There's some Welsh
Well,
in my family too, so
right. You said Petronel is Dutch?
It is, yeah. It's a Dutch name.
Yeah, it is really actually quite fascinating the importance of the naming and also the absolute and complete freedom of it. Like on one hand, you're constrained by the fact that you need it to work well, and on the other hand, there's a bazillion names to choose from. Yeah. The name of the protagonist in my novel, The Ghost Lords, is actually her name is Jordan. And I went ahead and chose that because my son's name is Jordy. And I wanted to actually, so like I actually have a family reason for that one. But for me, unfortunately, I'm not like in just one little place where I can just say what are Welsh names and name everyone that. It's a very global book. So I was specifically angling for different cultures and different traditions and ethnicities. So another character is named Gabriella because that is my husband's middle name is Gabrielle. So it's been sort of fun because I have the freedom to be like, oh, who do I know who it'd be really cool to tell them later, by the way, I named this character after you, right? So that's actually been, I'm like, I have my little list of people who I'm going to surprise at some point and say, guess what? This one's named after you. Okay, so fairy tales have changed, and you said you call this a dark fairy tale, but historically, all fairy tales pretty much were dark.
Exactly. Certainly the Grimm fairy tales that I grew up loving, the ones that were probably the darkest. I think that we have this idea now. I say there are kind of three myths of fairy tales now. One is that they're pretty. Two is that they have happy endings. And three is that they're black and white. And so when we talk about, the prettiness, the example I usually give is Cinderella. Because what do we think of as being, prettier than Cinderella? Glass slippers and pumpkins that turn into carriages and things like that, balls, royalty. And in the original story, when the stepsisters are trying to fit into the glass slipper, it's not just that their feet are too big so they can't get into them. Actually, they do cut off parts of their feet to get into the slipper. One cuts off her heel, the other cuts off, some toes. And the prince only realizes that they're not, the girl he fell in love with because he sees the blood trail, which is, I think, hilarious, and not so pretty. You know, we don't think of blood trails in Cinderella. And then in terms of the happy endings, the example I always give is Hansel and Gretel. So Hansel and Gretel are sent into the forest to starve by their parents. And in the end, they defeat the witch who was fattening up Hansel to eat him. And they take her treasure. And what do? They return home.
Right.
And the stepmother, who was actually the mother in the original version of the story, the stepmother has died, so now their father remains. And so he was the one who, albeit reluctantly, had led them off into the forest to starve. So they've returned to the man who did that. And that always, like, sat with me. Even when I wasn't consciously thinking, well, that's lousy, I had this kind of discomfort with the ending. And I think that we kind of lose touch with the uncomfortable parts of fairy tales.
Right.
And I think that's unfortunate, because I think they were meant to make people, they were meant to work through our discomforts. You know, in Hansel and Gretel, it's that terrible fear of starvation, that terrible fear of abandonment by your parents.
Right.
And so then when I talk about, you know, the black and white, I always think of Rumpelstiltskin, which is my all-time favorite fairy tale. And when I was speaking to a high school group recently, I said to them, okay, so in Rumpelstiltskin, who is the monster?
Mm-hmm.
And they all say, you know, it's kind of a guinea, you know, they all say Rumpelstiltskin. And I said, really? Because when you think about Rumpelstiltskin, what has happened? Is it really Rumpelstiltskin who's the monster? I mean, arguably, he's the one person in the story who keeps his promises, who is willing to keep his promises.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the father lies to a rich man to curry favor with him and tells him his daughter can do something that she can't. And then the rich man, the king, says to the daughter, well, if you do this thing for me, I'll marry you. And if you don't do this thing for me, I'll kill you.
Right, pretty creepy.
And yeah. And so the happy ending of that story is, yay, she manages to spin straw into gold, and she gets to, you know, marry the man who would have killed her if she hadn't done so.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's one of those that, you know, it sits with you in a very uncomfortable place if you really think about it.
And Rumpelstiltskin actually saves her life initially by giving her that power to, you know, by...
Correct. Now, look, I'm not saying Rumpelstiltskin was a great guy.
Right.
You know, I don't want to know what he wanted to do with her firstborn. I don't think any of us do. And, you know, I'm glad he didn't get that baby. But again, if he is a bad guy, which arguably he is, he's certainly not the only one. And I would argue certainly not even the most monstrous, because at least he is what he says he is, whereas the father is very much not.
Mm-hmm. Given the times when these stories were being created, and as you said earlier, they're oral traditions initially until they were eventually written down. So when what comes up for me when I'm thinking about Rumpelstiltskin is, you know, there were fathers who were put into horrible positions with regard to how to dispense with their daughters. That actually was probably a fear of many of the fathers, especially if they actually liked their daughters and were affectionate and cared for them. They were probably dreading what they would have to eventually do to that daughter. And then I don't think anyone trusted kings to care about anything other than money. Because if the king wanted more land or more wealth or to conquer a neighboring king, you know, for acquisition purposes, the peasants were going to be sent out to murder their brethren and to die themselves. So interestingly enough, it's actually so a little realistic, maybe.
Right. Fairy tales and, you know, dark fantasy, which is what I write. The stories might be fiction, but the fears are real.
Right. So you said that in this book, these people do something that might sound familiar to folks who are listening to this show right now. Let's see. They are scared of something that they don't quite understand, and it comes from somewhere else. And so they come up with this brilliant idea of building a wall to keep out the scary thing.
Right, exactly.
That's interesting. So what caused you to put that in there? And what are your thoughts about a wall?
Yeah, well, I wrote this novel before, 2016. It was sold to my publisher, Simon Schuster, in January of 2016, and I had written it over many years prior to that. So, long before any presidential candidates were talking about building walls between the United States and Mexico. But as Margaret Atwood has said in a number of interviews lately, talking about...
Well, let's make sure people know. So Margaret Atwood is the author of the book, The Handmaid's Tale.
Correct.
Right.
And it's on Hulu now as a television series, which is very exciting. And Handmaid's Tale is a wonderful novel that I recommend to everyone. It's riveting. And I definitely recommend you read it before you see the series if you possibly can.
Yes, I agree with that.
It's always best to do it in that order.
Yeah, I read the book twice. Definitely a good read.
Yeah. So people have asked Margaret Atwood over the years, but especially recently, or said how prescient she must be, that she predicted so many things. And she has always maintained that she didn't predict anything. She didn't put anything in her novel that hadn't already happened somewhere.
Right.
And so, the wall around this terrified village and the beast is an animal. I mean, we've always built walls, there are walled cities all over the world.
Great Wall of China.
Yeah, sure. And we have always created our own monsters out of our fears, the fear of the unknown. And we try to put a face on our fears because it's easier, it's containable that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can keep it out. If we label it, we can try to keep it out. And that's what the people in my novel do. And my protagonist, Alice, is far more afraid of the monster that she fears exists within herself than she is what might exist outside of the wall, which is, I think, an interesting contrast in my novel. You have these authoritarian figures who have a very black and white way of looking at the world. And Alice doesn't have such a black and white way. She definitely sees over the course of the novel how good and bad, particularly bad, she's afraid, exists within herself. But then increasingly she sees how good and bad exists in really everyone around her, maybe to different degrees, but no one is allowed to be all good or all bad.
Right. I mean, it's really fascinating when we watch human beings repeat what's happened before, I really, really wish that history as a subject matter was taught in American schools as a fabulous and incredible series of movies and plays and books, rather than this dry collection of dates and names, which are just so irrelevant to the important parts of history, which is the stories of why people act the way they do. It doesn't really matter who discovered Vashon Island or who discovered, Haiti. What matters is what drove a human being from where they were to want to overcome the challenges necessary in order to discover a new island or a new land, for example. What's the human condition and what were the fears involved and what was the greed and what was the hope? And, that is what can remind us in the modern day when we look around and go, ooh, there's that fear, there's that goal, there's that hope. Hey, the last time those three things happened on a societal level was in that period when those things occurred. Oh, I wonder how people today are going to respond to these three feelings, I am really curious to finish reading the book and find out a little bit more about what happens with how you've set up these people to try to protect themselves and what ends up actually truly resolving the issue.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I would say that I try not to make anything, too simple. I think the people do have things to be afraid of.
Absolutely.
I think that, they don't necessarily, they're not always necessarily afraid of the right things, but they have real fears, as we all do.
And thank goodness, because fear makes us pay attention. Right? And once we turn our brains on and keep our hearts in action and start talking to each other and paying attention to what's going on, humans are capable of incredible things.
Right.
So really quickly, I'm going to do a station identification here for folks that are just joining, you are listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on 101.9 FM, KVSH. My name is March Twisdale. I'm the producer and host of the show, and I'm chatting with Petronell Van Arsdell, the author of The Beast is an Animal. If you missed the start of the show, you can always go to marchtwisdale.com and pick it up online 24/7. Support is provided by Vashon Theater, the island's one and only movie house since 1947, striving to have something for everyone. The Vashon Theater has expanded their offerings to include National Theater, Bolshoi Ballet, and Art and Architecture Series. Information about all films at VashonTheater.com, and please watch locally. Also, support comes from Mostly True Vashon Tours. Based on the popular Mostly True History book series, these tours offer a lighthearted perspective on the island's past with visits to actual historical events and locations. Along the way, you experience all that Vashon has to offer in the way of local food, spirits, and recreation. Information and tickets are at VashonTours.com or drop by the Hinge Gallery located at Vashon Highway and 174th Avenue. So I was wondering, Petronell, if you could sort of, a lot of my listeners are writers themselves, not just mm-hmm. readers, and they may be interested in the genre of fairy tales, so to speak. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you feel makes a fairy, how do I say this, what makes a fairy tale different from just any other story?
Sure. I think what characterizes fairy tales is a sense of timelessness. They're not grounded in any particular, you know, reality or political system or place even. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mentioned that I had Welsh names, but it's not like my novel takes place in Wales, really. So I think, you know, fairy tales, for example, somebody recently who read The Beast as an Animal said to me that she liked that it could have taken place 500 years in the past or 500 years in the future. I mean, you know.
Ooh, that is
post-apocalyptically.
Such... Yes, that's a great point.
Yeah. So I think that is really something that fairy tales shares. You know, you get some freedom to create your own world, but you're not required to do the level of what's called world building, which is mm-hmm. not a phrase that I love, but nonetheless it's used, that, you know, you would associate with high fantasy, you know, like Game of Thrones, where, mm-hmm. I mean, the number of, you know, political structures and the history, and or even, you know, Lord of the Rings, you know, an earlier example of that, obviously. So that you don't have to do
because
so
those
much
are like
fairy tale.
Those are like entire worlds. I mean, it's sort of like Anne McCaffrey's work. I don't know if you've ever read her, but the Pern series. I mean, it's an entire planet. There's entire continents. Blah blah blah. So
right.
And there's
right.
all this backstory.
And you want to do, you know. I mean, I did a little bit of that because you want some sense of what the culture is, mm-hmm. but I don't think of fairy tale as being, I think they're different. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I have seen some readers say, oh, I wish she had done more world building. I wish she had done, you know, made this or that more complex. I think, oh, but that's not fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And I can understand the desire for that. And I can enjoy that when I read it. It's just not my strength as a writer. It's not what I'm particularly interested in doing as a writer.
No.
So, I think that's nice and it's freeing for writers who maybe love fantasy, but, you know, as I am, are not necessarily interested in creating, you know, multiple cultures or like writing their own language or something like
right.
that, like the Dothraki, you know, you don't have to do that in fairy tale.
Now, my impression is that most, I would say probably all ancient stories, especially those that originated in the oral tradition, and it doesn't matter what continent you're on, right? If mm-hmm. human beings were going to spend enough time sitting around memorizing a story and repeating it in roughly the same way, and you would have traveling bards and whatnot, those stories were not purely recreational. They always had, for lack of a better word, a moral or a message to send across.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if, and not every story has that. I mean, most fictional stories, there's a message, an inspiring idea that the author does hope the readers will pick up on. But I've always thought of, for me, when I grew up reading fairy tales, they were fairly brief and it was very clear what the moral of the story was. And I'm wondering if that is something that you also perceive as being a specific piece of a fairy tale.
I think that is more characteristic of some fairy tale traditions and not others.
Hmm.
For example, Hans Christian Andersen tends to be a bit more moralistic.
Mm-hmm.
It has more of an overtly Christian influence. But I wouldn't necessarily say the same thing of the Grimm fairy tales. Some Grimm fairy tales are I guess arguably more moralistic than others. But, I mean, I don't know that, you know, Hansel and Gretel, for example, has a moral.
Unless the moral is that you forgive your father no matter what horrible, terrible thing he did because it was the middle of a famine and you go bring him the gold.
I think that's something that I think about when I read it, but
mm-hmm.
I don't think that was a message that anybody, it was honor thy father and thy mother or anything like that. I actually think that was a creepy story told to reflect people's fears. So
mm-hmm.
I actually think of the fairy tales that draw me as being more speaking to people's fears than moral lessons that they want to instill.
Mm.
I mean, sure, when you read a story like Cinderella, I think there's vengeance. There's punishment. There's punishment for bad behavior.
The Little Mermaid has some interesting moral stories and does not have a happy ending. I mean, everyone
which is Hans Christian Andersen.
Yeah, everyone's like, oh, it's got a happy ending. It's like, no, it doesn't.
Yeah, and boy, oh my God, the feminist interpretations of that story, sacrificing your voice for a man is pretty intense.
Doesn't even work in the end.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, I know. I live here, of course, in the Pacific Northwest, and I interviewed a wonderful gentleman a couple of years ago who does a lot of Native storytelling, and
mm-hmm.
all of the stories, pretty much, all over North America. It doesn't really matter if it's on the East Coast, wherever it is, all of those stories, crow, raven, fox, what all these creatures do, they always do actually have sort of a moral. And all of those were oral for so long until very recently. So I imagine each community that heard each story and each listener took away their own message. The role of fear. Do you think there's hope offered very often in fairy tales? I'm trying to think through it myself.
I think there's a hope that you can prevail, sure. I think even if you look at a story like Rumpelstiltskin, I think that, the young woman ultimately prevails over incredibly difficult circumstances, and I think that she uses some wit in order to do that. Which
and
I
she
think
had
is
three
kind of
males
amazing.
Working against her dad,
exactly,
future husband,
exactly.
and Rumpelstiltskin,
And she ultimately, has to outwit... I mean, arguably she cheats him more than she outwits him, but she uses her intellect to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She figures out a way, and she kind of teases him, really. I mean,
mm-hmm.
when you think about that final scene of Rumpelstiltskin, when she's supposed to guess his name, she doesn't guess it right away. She kind of tortures him. She says the wrong name first, and then the wrong name second, and then she says, is it Rumpelstiltskin? And it drives him so mad, he pounds his way a hole in the floor and goes to hell. So she gets her revenge at the end. I mean, I wish she'd gotten some more revenge on her father and the king, but...
I know. Interesting.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about The Beast as an Animal. This story, it goes dark very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Boom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this one part, I'm going to see if I can actually find it. Let's see. So quickly. Right. So there's this part... let's see. So even when the goat that kept them alive,
mm-hmm.
And this is so sad for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is they come home to the shack where this goat this old goat that has always looked over them and has kept them alive. Somehow the door got left ajar or something, and the wolves came and massacred the goat, right? And I recently had to rehome my remaining chickens after about 3 weeks of repetitive raccoon massacres. So let me just say, after 11 years of besting the raccoons, they finally whooped my butt, and it was not a pleasant experience. It
I'm
was
sorry.
Wah.
I'm sorry.
And
chickens are very sweet.
I love my chicken.
Yeah.
My older son recently said that the absence of chickens on the property has been more of a life change for him than going to college.
You know, there is just something about chickens. My son became a vegetarian after a friend of his took him to visit some chickens.
Aww.
And he just couldn't eat meat anymore after that. That was just it for him.
Yeah.
And that was, I mean, it wasn't like he was a little kid when that happened. He was 17.
Mm-hmm.
So, they're sweet animals.
Yeah, you think they're just this packaged meat in the store.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, mm-hmm. we have
five.
And
then you have one sit in your lap and you think, oh.
Yeah. We have 5 acres, and we have always had all these chickens wandering around. And you know, if you call them, they'll come to the deck, and you throw food out to them or whatever. And
very sweet.
Amazing stories of chickens. So, anyways, here I am, of course, like, you know, the goat died.
I know.
And then it says, the older sister felt nothing. The younger sister had the glimmer of a memory of something called sadness, but it floated just out of her reach. They were girls no longer, nor were they women. They had become something else. And it's like, that's page 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, So I'm, since I haven't finished it, and I don't want to, like, what's that thing called where you give away the ending?
Spoiler.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone, but where are you going? As far as like the story arc for these characters who so quickly have been driven into such a very, very dark place.
Right.
And I mean,
Yeah. That's from the prologue. So the prologue takes place before, you know, the action of the rest of the novel. So it's giving the backstory of these two characters, twins, Angelica and Benedicta. And over the course of the prologue, which is only, you know, 12 pages, but it covers, you know, the expanse of their lives. They're 16 when the prologue ends, and they're just babies when it begins. So it very quickly moves through, you know, their stories. A lot of terrible things have happened to them. They weren't born girls who couldn't remember feeling love for their goat. That happened to them because they were betrayed by their father, and very badly so, and by their village as well. But the deeper betrayal was their own father, and that was a fear-based thing. Their mother was thought to be a witch, and they were thought to be the witch's spawns, basically, because the village was, you know, here we go back to that theme of hunger. Hunger drives people to do very bad things. The village was starving because there was a drought, and when people are afraid, as I said, they want to put a face on it. They want to have a cause. So they look to these girls and their mother as the cause. And so they're driven from the village. The father says that he'll come get them when things are better.
Mm-hmm.
And he never comes to get them.
Right.
So
he just moves on with his life, even worse.
He does. And when they discover that, they're pretty angry about that. So what that prologue is really kind of a fairy tale in and of itself. Almost self-contained. It could end kind of right there. But I go on to tell the story of what a betrayal like that can do to people and how that kind of anger and resentment and loss can turn us into monsters who then want to, hurt other people as well. So that is really a theme that runs throughout the novel then, not to give anything away.
Well, it is such a fascinating analogy. I think it's hopefully when someone reads this story, it will remind them of, I mean, you know, I would love for someone to read the story and then go, oh yeah, right. Humans have that fatal flaw where, you know, things are scary. We're not exactly quite sure, you know, what's causing it, and we want to fix it, so we'll find a scapegoat. Ironically enough, you know, this is the nice goat that, you know, made milk for the baby, you know, find a scapegoat, blame them, and that makes us feel better. And we sort of tend to forget to question, well, what if the scapegoat really is not the cause at all? But gee, at least we have something to be mad at, and we can all join together and, you know, feel like we're doing something, because no one wants to feel like you're powerless to do anything. Yeah, so I would love for lots of people to read this story and
Thank
come
you.
away, yeah, and come away thinking, okay, well, maybe I can see similar threads in humanity right now, today, and how
Well,
can this help me?
something else that comes out in The Beast as an Animal is that, you know, fear makes people do very understandable things, whether they're terrible things or not, as a separate thing. You know, we can understand why they do the things they do. But also, fear allows people to be taken advantage of by power structures. So the authority in the village that my protagonist Alice ends up going to, ends up living in, they take her in after her parents and the rest of the adults in her village are killed. The authority in that village has an interest in keeping the people fearful, because when people are afraid, they will believe that the powerful know best and can keep them safe, because it's a nice thing to believe. It's simple. You know, again, nothing new under the sun.
Well, and on that note, real quick, I'm going to do a station identification. So, folks, if you're just joining us, this is Marge Twisdell, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. And today I'm having a great time talking with Petronella Van Arsdell, the author of a fabulous sort of it's not a modern day, but it's been written currently in the modern day as a fairy tale. It's called The Beast is an Animal. So it's a new fairy tale for people who love Brothers Grimm. Is that how they were called?
Yes, the Brothers Grimm, yes.
People who love that, or Hans Christian Andersen, if you grew up loving fairy tales, this is a brand new one you've never heard before, and it has the same wonderful feeling that fairy tales give. So we're going to get back to chatting about a few more things, but first I'd like to give a shout out to the folks who make Voice of Vashon possible. That would include Island Spring Organics, 40 years of organic, non-GMO soy foods made daily right here on Vashon Island. Tours available at islandspringorganics.com, or you can call them at 206-463-9848. Support for this program also comes from Vashon Center for the Arts, a center for the arts on Vashon Island. VCA provides quality arts experiences for all ages and creates opportunities for artists to perform and exhibit their work. Find out what's happening at vashoncenterforthearts.org. And I'm wondering if you wanted to touch in a little bit about adult female roles that were standard and traditional in fairy tales in the past, because what I well I for a moment I thought that the mother of these two girls was actually a new archetype, but she still matches up with sort of the sweet woman mom who, of course, ends up dead.
Huh, interesting. I mean, yes. I do think she's the mom who ends up dead, certainly, the mother in the prologue. I guess I would push back a little bit against the notion that she's sweet. I think that she's just a human being. She's a human being who lives at a time that is really rough on women.
But she wasn't like the evil stepmother or the witch or the nagging. She wasn't even a nagging wife, really, was she?
No, we don't really know anything about what she was as a wife. I
Right.
think she worked hard and her husband worked hard. I think as a mother, she did, you know, reasonably okay by her daughters. She kept them alive. But at a certain point, she descends into just grief. If anything,
right.
she's wrecked by what's happened to her, understandably so. Again, we're talking about the prologue, which is 12 pages, so it really genuinely is a fairy tale. It's not meant to. We're not meant to totally understand her as a character, unlike the rest of the novel, where you have, you know, fuller character development.
Right, right.
I guess the way I think of the women in my novel
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, archetypes are powerful, and I certainly am inspired by them. I think that archetypes are such for a reason, and it's very important to me that no character in my novel is purely good or purely bad.
Right.
Again, there's some maybe 90% bad, but they're all human beings. And I do see the mother as a human being, and archetypes are something else. I don't think of her as a saint. I don't think of her as the sainted mother who dies, you know, before the action begins, for example, as in Snow White. Yeah.
Right. I guess we have existed in a patriarchal system for a period of time. There were matriarchies prior to the sort of global patriarchy that we're dealing with in a lot of ways right now. And there was always sort of, there's been that issue of how are women affected by that, and how are they then rendered in stories and plays,
right.
and things
and
like that.
That's the key, right, is the rendering.
Right.
That is what we're talking about, is how they're viewed.
Exactly.
So an archetype is that. It's how women are viewed. Whereas in my novel, I was trying to break that down. So, you know, for instance, when Alice goes to the new village and she's taken in by a married couple who don't have children, many people who have read it said that they initially thought that that character was going to be a wicked stepmother character because she's rather dour. But, you know, and I don't want to give too much away here, but gradually that character becomes much more complex,
mm-hmm.
Which is...
So you were saying that the stepmother sort of surprised people.
Yeah, I think that people were expecting, you know, you read stepmother and you think, you
right.
know, witch, bad
yeah.
lady. But that would be the archetype or the stereotype.
Right.
More like, but yeah, I didn't want to do that.
So I was wondering if you had intentionality, I mean, for about shifting, like for example, unlike Hansel and Gretel, where the mom and the dad both send the kids out, you know, in this case, the mom went with the kids. And I'm not sure if that was actually a choice. I had the impression that the villagers were going to come for the children, and to hide the kids, they didn't just like give up the kids, and they didn't just throw the kids alone into the forest, but the mom left. Or was the mom also
no,
in
the
danger?
No, the mother was thought to be the witch, and the children were the witch's spawn.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, got it.
So they had to, it was the father was the one who had a choice. He could have
right.
gone away with all of them. He could have taken them all away.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, sent the mother and the children off and promised to join them. Now, even in those 12 pages, I tried to make it clear that his decision was a very, very hard one,
mm-hmm.
because it wasn't like other villages were going to be eager to take them in. They would have looked very suspiciously upon somebody who was clearly banished from where he lived before.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah.
And he seemed very nice.
They said had a set of bad choices to make.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but he happened to have chosen the one that was better for him.
Well,
certainly.
Right. So throughout the rest of the book, which is, you know, out of the prologue and into sort of the full breadth of the story, did was it something that came up for you? Like, do I want to challenge some of the traditional fairy tale characterizations of female characters, or was that not something that you were concerned about?
No, it wasn't. I wouldn't say I wasn't concerned about it, because I'm definitely strongly feminist and I think about these issues and very much on a daily basis. But my primary goal always is just to tell a great story.
Right.
And I think the way you tell a great story is to have your characters be fully realized human beings. So that's my goal, is to make sure everybody's fully realized, you know, male, female, and everything, you know, however, you know, my characters identify themselves.
And in general, fairy tales, in general, fairy tales paint more of a cardboard cutout, two-dimensional character. So simply by giving these people, how do I put it? You know, by treating them as if they are real human beings instead of just a tool to suggest this or that, just sort of like automatically it shifted it, it sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So even calling my novel a fairy tale, you know, it is, but just by nature of being a novel,
right,
it's got to be more complex than, you know, what we would think of, you know, as
right,
a fairy tale.
Yeah. No, I think we should probably, as we come to an end, we should probably be clear about that, that even though you call it a dark fairy tale, it is 300 some odd pages. It is definitely a novel. It doesn't
right,
have
fully
like,
developed characters and plot.
Right. It's a normal sized book. It's not like, you know, with a bunch of pictures or something. It's almost as if you you took the fairy tale construct and you elevated it, you know, and spread it out and gave it breadth and you know, just poof, made it bigger.
Oh, well, thank you. I think I made it certainly atmospherically, there's a sense of it being a fairy tale. And I would say that tonally, the prologue has a very fairy tale feel because it has that somewhat distanced narration.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get into the novel, then it's very much from my protagonist's point of view. So you have that, you know, close personal third-person narration that allows you to get a little bit more insight into what's happening to a character. That's not the way fairy tales traditionally were told, obviously.
Right. Now, for my
more omnisciently.
Mm-hmm. Right, for my moms and dads and aunts and uncles and grandparents out there that are wondering if they should pick up this book for, you know, a young woman in their family, does Alice have sort of, is she a good role model for teen girls?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I think she grapples with things, and teen boys, frankly. She grapples with things that all of us do to some extent. And I think that the emotional journey that she travels in the book is very real. I hope, my greatest hope is that adolescents will get a great deal out of that, as I think adults will, because I think a lot of us have that. What she searches for is an understanding of not just who she is, but what she is. And she's very afraid that there's something wrong with her, that she's a bad person. And I think many of us carry that around with us. And so she has to come to a place of kind of figuring out what she thinks of herself.
Well, especially in the teen years.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, thank you, Petronelle, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are out of time, and that's our show. I'd like, though, to make sure that people who are interested in finding out more about The Beast is an Animal can probably go to their local independent bookseller and check in with them and ask them their opinions. It sounds like you definitely have, you did a tour of independent bookstores?
Yeah, I did what's called a pre-publication tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a bunch of independent booksellers, and also, I did the Texas Library Association meeting last week. I need to give a shout out to the librarians out there who I love.
Yay.
You also carry The Beast as an Animal. So,
oh, librarians are the best.
Library is also a place to go.
I love librarians. I just adore librarians. They're the one of the groups of unsung heroes in the world.
Absolutely. Librarians and booksellers, they're doing great work. Yeah.
And people can check out your website, so I'm going to spell it out real quick. It's PetronelleVanArsdale.com, which is P-E-T-E-R, NELLEVANARSDALE. And then you said you're on Twitter at PetternellVA as well.
Correct. Correct.
Excellent. Awesome. All right. Well, I thank you again so much for calling me from New York.
Thank you.
All right. So that's our show, folks. My name is March Twisdale, and you've been listening to my interview with Petronella Van Arsdell. I'd like to thank you for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guest authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. And now I'll leave you with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns, while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. He will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many. You are the few.